Penguin Random House Audio presents In the Shadow of the Gods, The Emperor in World History, by Dominic Leaven. Read for you by John Lee. This book is dedicated to Trinity College, Cambridge, to its masters and fellows, to its students, and to the college staff who did so much to make my time at Trinity so pleasant and productive. Preface and Acknowledgements. This book is about emperors. Probably most listeners will come to the book believing that they know what an emperor is. No illusion could be more fatal. Emperors come in many different shapes and sizes. Empire is one of the most contested words in history and politics. In Chapter 1, I will delve deeper into these questions. For the moment, I will confine myself to saying that my book studies the hereditary holders of supreme authority in many of the most powerful and significant polities in history. In principle, this is a global history of emperors. In practice, I limit myself, before the 16th century CE, to Eurasia and North Africa. The surviving sources do not allow a historian to know much about the personalities of emperors in the Americas and sub-Saharan Africa before that time. Sheer despair at the already enormous scale of my project was an extra deterrent to extending its limits even further from my comfort zone. The most obvious point about a topic of this scale is that much more needs to be left out than can be included. Some important empires, even in Eurasia, get barely a mention in this book. The Byzantine, Carolingian, Sasanian, Seljuk, and Southeast Asian empires head the list. Even among the empires I do study, I am forced to concentrate on specific periods and reigns. It is sometimes hard to avoid looking most intently at empires in their prime. Almost every sentence in this book deserves a paragraph. Nearly every statement ought to come with a string of qualifications, exceptions, and nuances attached. The role of emperors in the history of the world is so vast and fascinating a topic that one is almost bound to feel a sense of failure when concluding a book on this subject. If most readers conclude that this book is a heroic, thought-provoking, and sometimes amusing failure, I will be more than content. Inevitably, how I approach this topic and the themes I chose to emphasize to some extent reflect my own academic and personal background and experience. In academic terms, I am, above all, a historian of Imperial Russia, and an international historian. Geopolitics, diplomacy, and war loom large in this book, in my view correctly so, given their importance to the rulers of empires. In personal terms, I come from a mixed background, but one in which empire was an all-pervading theme. Ireland, British India, Imperial Russia, and the Baltic German community all lurked in my childhood and adolescence. In those years, the dominant identities were British, Imperial, and Catholic, both of which, to a great extent, imploded in the late 1960s and early 1970s. Into the hole they left moved Imperial Russia, the world of my father's family, to whose study I have devoted most of the past 50 years of my life. Nevertheless, Tsarist Russia never occupied the whole space. In 1991, the Latvian government generously restored to me the citizenship which my father had possessed until his homeland was annexed by Stalin in 1940. The collapse of the Berlin Wall and the re-emergence of Central Europe got me so excited that I christened my son Maximilian Leopold in honor of my Austrian godfather and the Habsburgs, the supreme embodiments of Central Europe's history. The memory of empire in our family was by no means simply triumphalist. Thanks to his wonderfully intelligent and humane education at an excellent French state lycée, my father's mindset was that of a left-leaning Parisian intellectual, with little nostalgia for any old regime. The empires my family served had all collapsed, amidst considerable chaos and tragedy. Moreover, my father's family had never been unequivocally Russian in the modern meaning of the word, and none of our ancestors were ever English. As children, we spent weeks of every summer at the house of Hubert Butler, near Kilkenny. Hubert was a Protestant gentleman from a minor branch of a family whose heads had been the Dukes of Ormond. He was, nevertheless, a famous Gaelic scholar, and a strong, if idiosyncratic, Irish patriot. Adolescent memories of Ireland would have large houses which were damp and cold, for reasons of both tradition and penury. The strangest was Clonalis, in Roscommon, home of O'Connor Don, descendant of the High Kings of Ireland, who reigned in the 11th century before the English came. If you overslept in one of the four-poster beds at Clonalis, you were liable to be woken by guided tours of Irish-American tourists in search of their roots. On the other hand, if you ventured onto the top floor on a rainy day, Roscommon is about the rainiest county in Ireland, it was wise to take an umbrella. My only middle-class great-grandfather, Pringle Kennedy, was the most interesting of the four. Born in India, he barely escaped death in the 1857 rebellion. A successful barrister, but also a fine amateur scholar, after the death of my great-grandmother, he had the considerable courage, for a man of his class and era, to marry an Indian woman. Both she and my grandmother's sister were assassinated in 1908 by an Indian nationalist, who mistook their carriage for that of an unpopular British official. Both British and Indian accounts of the assassination, a cause célèbre at the time, had their reasons for not mentioning that one of the two victims was an Indian woman. For more than half of my life, I have been married to a Japanese woman and have spent at least one-third of every year in Japan. This has been an education. The past, present, and future look different when viewed from Tokyo. More recently, a partly Jewish son-in-law and a mostly Filipina daughter-in-law have added happily to the mix. This book was largely written in our country home on what one might describe as a high hill or small mountain, depending on whether or not one is in a romantic mood. As I look out through the windows of my study, Mount Fuji dominates the view in all its majesty and beauty. On a clear day, one can see 100 miles or more, out to the Pacific Ocean and beyond. During a pandemic, this was a scholar's paradise. The awfulness of the pandemic, of course, interrupted life in this paradise. This is a good moment to pay tribute to two of my dearest friends, Professors Hari Vasudevan and David Washbrook, both of whom died at this time. Donald Trump's rantings were an even greater source of long-term anxiety than the pandemic itself. I was sustained by my daily Financial Times and by a plentiful store of Marmite, surest of all English identity markers. Amidst this riot of conflicting identities and loyalties, on one point I have always been clear. I am a British, and specifically Cambridge, historian. Much of what has been most valuable in my life is owed to the education I received in the Cambridge History Faculty. My deep thanks go to my former teachers. The greatest of all my debts, as regards writing this book, comes last. It is to Trinity College, Cambridge. For 8 years, I was a senior research fellow at Trinity. In other words, a de facto research professor at Cambridge University with no administrative or teaching responsibilities. In all circumstances, this is a position of privilege almost unequaled among humanities professors in British academia. Given the state of my eyes, there is no chance that this book would have been written had I carried a normal load of administration and teaching. So, in the most literal sense, this book is owed to Trinity. In a broader sense, my 8 years at Trinity were enormously fruitful and pleasant, thanks to my colleagues and fellows, to the masters, Lord Martin Rees and Sir Gregory Winter, to the history students, and to the wonderful college staff who did so much to help me at every turn. To all of them, and above all to Trinity itself, this book is dedicated. Along with thanks, there must also be apologies. Even when I began my last book, Towards the Flame, Empire, War, and the End of Tsarist Russia, I was having increasing eye and deep ear balance problems. These were greatly exacerbated by high-intensive work in the Russian archives on old manuscripts and microfilm. When I returned from the archives, I was unable to read at all for a month. Subsequently, things improved, and during most of my research for this book, I was able to read for 6 hours a day, so long as I was careful. For a book of these dimensions, that barely sufficed. Just as I was beginning work on this book, Frederick Paulson gave me an immensely generous donation to set up a foundation to help Russian, especially young, historians. Running this foundation.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?